The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine dated May 10th, 2013. Boy, this year is going by fast, isn't it? We will begin with the main story section, as we always do. The first article this week is entitled, Obama Weighs U.S. Options in Syria. President Obama was reportedly moving this week towards supplying weapons to rebels in Syria as evidence mounted that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had resorted to chemical weapons. Obama has said since last year that the use of chemical weapons would constitute a red line for the U.S. Last week, the White House said it had reason to believe, with varying degrees of confidence, that the banned nerve agent sarin had been used in Syria, as France, the U.K., and Israel have recently asserted. In a White House press conference this week, Obama said the U.S. government had not yet confirmed a chain of custody that establishes exactly what happened, and still had to exclude the possibility that rebel groups use the poison gas, as the government contends. If I can establish the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime in a way that the U.S. and international community can be sure of, that is a game changer, said Obama. Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham called on Obama to lay out a clear line of action. Assad has crossed the president's red line, they said. Unfortunately, the red line has been blurred with each passing day. Meanwhile, the conflict in Syria intensified in Damascus this past week as two large bombs exploded in the capital. The Syrian prime minister narrowly escaped the first attack, which killed 9 people, and a second bomb a day later killed at least 13 people and injured scores of others. No group claimed responsibility for the blasts, which the Syrian government blamed on terrorists. Now here's what the editorials had to say. We're beginning to wish Obama had never issued his famous red line warning, said the Wall Street Journal. What's the point if he intends to do nothing when Assad crosses it? A red line once set should mean something, said BostonHerald.com, but Obama continues to yammer about needing more proof. If he fails to act, it will signal to Iran and North Korea that they can ignore him. For all their exhortations, said the New York Times, the hawks shouting for intervention have no coherent plan of their own, specifically one that wouldn't involve dragging the United States into another extended and costly war. There are no easy options in Syria, and Obama is right to move with caution. Now here's what the columnist had to say about all this. Obama brought this dilemma on himself, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. Assad's use of chemical weapons is an absolutely predictable consequence of the White House's policy, which is pretty much not to have one. Obama sat by while at least 70,000 Syrians have been slaughtered, refusing to arm the rebels or impose a no-fly zone because he doesn't want to get involved in another war in the Middle East. Well, in case he hasn't noticed, one is already underway in Syria, and America and its allies are losing. It's still not too late, said Lionel Beer in USAtoday.com. If Obama installs a no-fly zone or arms those rebels we can trust, the U.S. can help forge a peaceful future in the region. If he doesn't, the message is loud and clear. The U.S. is happy to let the Middle East become a cesspool of violence and anti-Americanism for generations, and aspiring despots should feel free to use WMDs at will. That all sounds noble in theory, said David Horsey in the Los Angeles Times, but getting involved in serious civil war will have many unintended consequences. What do we do if our pilots are shot down by serious, sophisticated air defenses and taken hostage, or our weapons fall into the hands of jihadists like the pro-Al-Qaeda Jabhat al-Nusra? Well, not too many years ago, we armed the Afghan rebels against the Soviets. Those rebels became the Taliban. Do we really need to repeat this mistake? Every argument for American involvement in Syria shares the same fault, said Greg Skoblete in RealClearPolitics.com. They all treat the fall of Assad as the end of the problem, when in fact it would be just the beginning. Toppling the tyrant would present a whole new set of questions. Who will stop Iran from hijacking the new government? Who will protect the Alawites and other minorities from reprisal killings? Heartbreaking as the situation in Syria is, if we can't answer these questions, we had best stay out. The next item in the main story section of the Week magazine is the Boston bombing investigators look abroad. The FBI expanded its investigation into the Boston Marathon bombing last week into a search for possible co-conspirators after Russian officials said that bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev met with Islamic militants on a 2012 trip there. Authorities were focused on the elder Tsarnaev brothers' six-month visit to Dagestan, a violence-plagued Islamic province bordering Chechnya. While there, Russian officials told the FBI he met with jihadist recruiter Mohammad Mansour Nidal, who died in a gun battle with Russian forces last year. Russian officials also said that Tsarnaev, 26, who died in a shootout with police in Watertown, Massachusetts, exchanged emails with William Plotnikov, an ethnic Russian from Canada who joined the Islamist insurgency in Dagestan. Russian police killed Plotnikov in July, and Tsarnaev returned to the U.S. a few days later. He intended to join the fighters, said a Russian official, but he lost his contacts. Investigators were attempting to determine the source of a bit of female DNA found on one of the pressure cookers used as explosive devices on the attacks. They obtained a DNA sample from Catherine Russell, Tamerlan's 24-year-old American wife, who denies any role in the bombing. The younger Tsarnaev brother, Jokar, 19, who has been charged with planting one of the bombs, was moved to a prison medical facility last week. His legal team, NBC News reported, is trying to negotiate a deal in which he'd tell all he knows about the Boston attacks in exchange for prosecutors promising not to seek the death penalty. Now here's what the editorial said. Law enforcement agencies can't be expected to stop every attack any more than they can prevent every mass shooting, said the Washington Post. Still, there are troubling questions about why the FBI lost track of Tamerlan Tsarnaev after Russia identified him as a possible Islamic radical in 2011. The FBI questioned Tamerlan, but never learned from customs officials that he later traveled to Dagestan, a region rife with extremism. Tamerlan should have been under active surveillance for the past 2 years, said the Washington Examiner, but the FBI is blinded by political correctness. In 2011, the Bureau's training manuals were systematically purged of content linking radical Islam with terrorism. It's possible that the agents who interviewed Tamerlan overlooked the warning signs, such as the jihadist videos posted on his Facebook page, because that's what they were trained to do. Now here's what the columnist said. There were good reasons the Russian tip didn't trigger a more aggressive American investigation, said Eli Lake in the DailyBeast.com. The Russians, like many other repressive regimes, routinely label expatriates and political dissidents abroad as terrorists. Partly because of such false reports, the FBI's watch list alone includes some 700,000 names. Try keeping track of that many people. If you want to know why the Tsarnaevs were radicalized, said Glenn Greenwald in Guardian.co.uk, start with the horrific violence brought by the U.S. and its allies to the Muslim world. Shokar told investigators that he and his brother were motivated by the manslaughter of Muslims by Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq, the same reason given by many other homegrown terrorists. In the case of Tamerlan, personal alienation also played a role, said Deborah Sontag in the New York Times. He'd hoped to box in Olympics for the U.S. after twice winning the New England Golden Gloves Championship. But in 2010, rules were changed to bar non-citizens from competing in the national tournament, and the Soviet-born fighter bitterly gave up the sport. After his more secular dreams were dashed, friends and family say Tamerlan channeled his anger into an extremist, anti-American form of Islam. It's not accurate to say the brothers were self-radicalized, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. Like other lone wolf terrorists, they became extremists with the help of online al-Qaeda propaganda that glorifies making war on infidels and provides detailed tips on how to make bombs. Through the Internet and its regional cells, al-Qaeda remains a threat, and its branches in Yemen, Pakistan, and elsewhere still need to be dismantled. And the next item is the controversy of the week from the main stories section. The article is entitled, George W. Bush, A New Look at His Legacy. Former President George W. Bush is in the political wilderness no more, said Fred Barnes in WeeklyStandard.com. The 43rd president's library and museum were dedicated last week, coinciding with a surge in popularity for the unfairly maligned former president. Bush now has a favorability rating of 47%, about the same as President Obama's and more than 20 points higher than when Bush left office. A reevaluation of his legacy is beginning to take hold. Bush's record deserves a second look, said Victor Davis Hansen in NationalReview.com. He wasn't eloquent or slick, but he was a good man who calmed and united the country post 9/11 and kept us safe from further attacks on U.S. soil. While mistakes were made in Iraq, his Churchillian surge in 2006 and 7 helped turn the tide. Liberals afflicted with Bush derangement syndrome portrayed W. as a callous moron, but people once scorned Harry Truman, too. Bush's warranted rehabilitation will come. You can't be serious, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. Bush's apologists are now arguing that from 9/12 on, he kept us safe. The judicious bit of editing cuts out the fact that the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil in history happened on his watch. In August 2001, Bush was on vacation at his Texas ranch when he was hand-delivered a CIA memo entitled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S., with specific warnings about airplanes. All right, Bush told the briefer, you've covered your ass now. He then went back to driving his shiny pickup around his ranch. A month later, 3,000 people died. Saying Bush kept America safe after 9/11 is like saying, other than that iceberg, the Titanic had a pleasant voyage. The catastrophes kept piling up after that, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. A simpleton who ignored evidence in favor of his gut, Bush led us into a bloody and costly war in Iraq on deliberately cooked intelligence and then horribly botched the occupation, pinning our military down there for a decade. He presided over an economy sustained by easy credit and an unsustainable housing bubble, which directly caused the 2008 meltdown. His unfunded wars and unaffordable tax cuts turned a budget surplus into a $1 trillion annual deficit. History will not be kind to Bush because his 8-year presidency was a full disaster at home and abroad. Actually, Bush wasn't all bad, said Matthew Iglesias in Slate.com. His oft-derided No Child Left Behind Act gave previously abandoned low-income students a chance to succeed. His Medicare prescription drug program, while costly, has helped millions pay for needed medications. His homelessness policies led to a 30% drop in the number of people living on the street. He even had some worthy failures, like his doomed 2007 attempt at sensible immigration reform. That doesn't make up for Bush's economic and foreign policy failures, but a lot of things look different once the partisan fights of the moment are over. No matter how many years pass, said Ramesh Ponnuru in Bloomberg.com, it will be obvious that Bush lacked an essential ingredient, competence. He screwed up Iraq, Katrina, and the economy so badly that to this day voters don't really trust Republicans to govern. Yet while today's GOP rejects the compassion in Bush's conservatism, it still clings to Bush's unpopular supply-side economics, his tax cut mania, and his naive belief in military adventures abroad. That's George W. Bush's political legacy, a weakened Republican Party unable to face its flaws. Now from the main story section, we'll turn to the briefing from the Week magazine for this week. And the briefing article is entitled, The Search for a Better Battery. The limitations of 20th century batteries are holding back technological progress. Is a breakthrough in sight? What is the state-of-the-art battery? The lithium-ion battery, which powers everything from the cell phone in your pocket to airplane flight systems and electric cars, lithium-ion batteries have been used commercially since 1991, and there are more than 1.8 billion of them in use. Their capabilities have helped lead to huge advances in digital technology. They recharge within hours, can keep portable electronics going for days, and yet are small enough to fit inside pocket devices. But most lithium-ion batteries produce levels of energy too low to power large machines and expire within 3 years. While a single cell is enough to power an iPhone, airplanes and cars need to be stocked with rows of batteries. Such large arrays can overheat and burst into flame. Like the 63-pound battery pack that caused a fire inside a Boeing 787 Dreamliner earlier this year. Many engineers believe the lithium-ion battery's performance has been stretched about as far as it can go. We need to leapfrog the engineering of making batteries, said Vince Battaglia, a battery scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. We've got to find the next big thing. What do engineers need a new battery to do? Recharge more quickly, store more energy, and discharge it for longer. The limitations of our current technology are most apparent in batteries for electric cars, which run out of energy every 100 miles or so and take up to 4 hours to recharge, yet cost as much as $15,000 each. The lack of affordable, highly functional batteries has been a particularly high barrier to the widespread adoption of electric cars, said a 2010 Department of Energy report. But a significant improvement in battery technology would boost more than electric vehicles. It could help sustainable energy overtake nuclear and fossil fuels by allowing the power produced when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining to be stored for times when the wind and sun are not cooperating. If you crack it, said Jay Whitaker of Carnegie Mellon University, it'll change the world. What's the likeliest candidate? A lithium air battery is the best chance battery scientists have to beat gasoline, said Seth Fletcher, author of Bottled Lightning, a book about lithium technology. An ordinary lithium-ion battery contains electrodes of carbon and a lithium compound. A lithium-air battery would effectively use atmospheric oxygen as an electrode rather than pure carbon, providing much more energy intensity. There are still several vexing obstacles to lie-air batteries, not least the fact that pure lithium is explosively reactive with water and the air. IBM is one of several companies trying to build one, but the technology is said to be in its infancy. Other researchers are exploring metallic alternatives to lithium, such as magnesium. How would that work? Magnesium has more reactive electrons than lithium, meaning it could theoretically store much more energy. But it's very difficult to get magnesium to release those electrons inside a battery. Toyota said last year that it had conducted positive early tests on a magnesium 10 battery, but said it was still a decade away from commercial development. Z-Power, a California-based startup, created a working power cell that runs on silver and zinc, but it could not match the voltage of a similar-sized Li-Ion battery. None of these alternatives has yet edged ahead of the pack. Right now, it's a horse race, said George Blomgren, a former researcher at EverReady. There's deficiencies in every technology that's out there. Is the government helping the research? It's trying to. In the president's first term, the Obama administration invested $2.4 billion in 29 private firms working on power cells for electric cars. But many of those firms have struggled financially because they haven't made progress they can bring to the market. Battery maker A123 filed for bankruptcy last year, having received $249 million from taxpayers. Undeterred, the Department of Energy invested $120 million last year in the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research, a partnership among five national laboratories, five universities, and four private firms to push forward battery technology in the U.S. Then Energy Secretary Stephen Chu pledged that JCESR would create batteries five times more powerful and five times cheaper within 5 years. Not everyone believes the project will succeed. This is the definition of a money hole, said energy analyst Robert Enderle. Is 5 years unrealistic? History would suggest so. Advances in battery technology tend to happen incrementally. Since French physicist Gaston Plante invented the first rechargeable battery 154 years ago, battery performance has improved only eightfold. Modern electronics function so well only because improvements to silicon chip technology enable them to use available electric power much more efficiently. Plante's breakthrough, not incidentally, was the lead-acid battery, technology that is still in use today in hundreds of millions of automobiles. Its staying power is a remarkable testament to first how robust that chemistry is and how difficult change is, said Whitaker. But researchers on a quest to build a better battery can take comfort from the words of Thomas Edison, who discovered the nickel-iron battery in 1901. I don't think nature would be so unkind as to withhold the secret of a good storage battery, Edison said, if a real earnest hunt for it is made. And the footnote to this particular briefing article is called Graphene Supercapacitors. When progress comes, it can look almost like an accident. Last year, UCLA chemistry student Maher El-Khadi figured out a way to use the laser in a cheap DVD burner to produce a graphene, a carbon material that has extraordinary electrical properties but is notoriously expensive to manufacture. Using sheets of graphene manufactured by El-Khadi's method, a UCLA team has since made a high-efficiency supercapacitor, a device that stores energy like a battery, but recharges up to 100,000 times more quickly. They're now working on commercial applications that could one day find their way into cell phones or even electric vehicles. Richard Kaner, El-Khadi's supervisor, said that while the breakthrough was a surprise, it built on years of experiments. Nothing in science is actually an accident, he said. It only looks that way when you look back. And now we'll turn to the good week for and the bad week for this week edition, May 10th, 2013. It was a good week for discerning prisoners who can now write reviews of American jails on the rating site Yelp.com. The kitchen used local farms and put great thought into their seasonally changing menu, read one 3-star review of San Quentin Prison. It was a good week for second thoughts after former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said the court should have refused to hear Bush versus Gore, the 2000 decision that ended the Florida recount and made George W. Bush president. The 5-4 ruling along partisan lines gave the court a less than perfect reputation, she said. And it was a good week for wolves after a group of scientists in Uruguay announced that they had successfully modified the genetic makeup of a group of sheep to make them glow in the dark. A good week for wolves. Yeah, I think I get that. And it was a bad week for Double or Nothing after a New Hampshire man spent his entire life savings, $2,600, on a carnival ball toss game, only to win a stuffed banana. You just get caught up in the whole I've got to win my money back thing, said Henry Gribben, who is 30 years old. It was a bad week for show and tell after a Minnesota firearms instructor shot himself in the hand while trying to show that his handgun wouldn't go off in his holster. The gun was pointed in a safe direction, said Fred Peterson, 66, but my finger was not in a good spot. And it was a bad week for a taste of your own medicine. After an elderly Swedish couple took revenge on a noisy neighbor by blasting heavy metal music at full volume around the clock, I am completely broken down, said the neighbor. How can I keep living here? And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for May 10th, 2013. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. this past week, as determined by the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Can Islamic Terrorists Be White? By Peter Beinart and thedailybeast.com. Are the Tsarnaev brothers white? Asked Peter Beinart. That question became a partisan flashpoint during the hunt for the Boston bombers when one liberal columnist expressed a wish that they turn out to be white, right-wing extremists rather than Islamic terrorists. When police identified the bombers as Tamerlan and Jokhar Tsarnaev, ethnic Chechen immigrants, some conservative bloggers were gleeful, writing that, the terrorists were not white Americans. Actually, the Tsarnaevs are white Americans. One brother is a citizen and the other was a legal resident. They have white skin, come from a Caucasian region, and are literally Caucasian. But in our country's dominant culture, white doesn't refer simply to skin color. It means one of us. Since 9/11, the world's 1.6 billion Muslims have been viewed as intrinsically not white, no matter what they look like. Younger brother Jokhar, in particular, does not fit into the terrorist stereotype. He was a popular wrestler and lifeguard, a devotee of hip-hop, and a typical pot-smoking American college student, until he embraced Islamic extremism. At that point, evidently, his racial category has also changed. The next column is The Danger of Reagan Worship by Jennifer Rubin in The Washington Post. The Republican Party faces a critical choice, said Jennifer Rubin. It can remain a Ronald Reagan historical society, or it can try to endure as a force in national politics. But it can't do both. The right's reverence for Reagan is understandable, since he proved that conservatism can be both popular and an effective governing strategy. But this is no longer 1980, and America is no longer Reagan's America. Today, voters expect expect government to solve problems, not merely stand aside. The GOP cannot win national elections if it is ruled by angry purists conducting search and destroy missions against ideological deviations from Reagan's playbook. The enforcers are painting the party into an extremist corner on deficit reduction and taxes, same-sex marriage, and immigration reform, thus alienating tens of millions of independents, young voters, and minorities. The true essence of conservatism is not this kind of bitter rigidity, but the promotion of personal liberty and free markets. To win elections, Republicans must change their tone and evolve to meet 21st century challenges. The creation of a new right is the party's only hope for survival. The next column is entitled Too Many Doctors in the House by Charles C.W. Cook. NationalReview.com is where this particular column appeared. If you go around calling yourself doctor, said Charles C.W. Cook, you should have a medical degree. Unfortunately, the country is now lousy with people who insist on being called doctor because they once wrote an arcane thesis. Vice President Joe Biden's wife relentlessly calls herself Dr. Biden, even though her doctorate is in educational leadership. Whatever the hell that is. Why use this title? It confers a certain better-than-thou status, proving that Dr. Biden is smart. Other faux doctors who exploit the title include the impressive-sounding Princeton philosopher Dr. Cornel West and the author Dr. Maya Angelou, who has 30 honorary doctorates from various colleges. A Ph.D. literally means you're a doctor of philosophy, and in practice it simply means you've spent a lot of time in academia and are now qualified to teach in a university. In a professional context, a doctor of English literature is justified in using the title. But of what relevance is it in everyday life? When people cling to trophy credentials to prove they're smarter than everyone else, it suggests that maybe they're not. And now we'll flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week for The Last Word. This week, The Last Word article is entitled Defined by Your Category. Labels like working class and black aren't mere descriptions, said Adam Alter. They can shape your identity. Long ago, humans began labeling and cataloging each other. Eventually, lighter-skinned humans became whites, darker-skinned humans became blacks, and people with intermediate skin tones became yellow, red, or brown-skinned. These labels don't reflect reality faithfully, and if you lined up 1,000 randomly selected people from across the earth, none of them would share exactly the same skin tone. Of course, the continuity of skin tone hasn't stopped humans from assigning each other to discrete categories like black and white, categories that have no basis in biology, but nonetheless go on to determine the social, political, and economic well-being of their members. These racial labels impose boundaries and categories on an infinitely complex social world, but once in place, these boundaries are very difficult to dissolve. People are apt to resolve racial ambiguity by resorting to racial labels. In a Stanford University study, an experimenter showed white students a picture of a young man whose facial features made it difficult to determine whether he was white or black. For half the students, the man was labeled white, and for the other half, he was labeled black. The students were asked to draw the image in front of them as accurately as they could. To sweeten the deal, the student who created the most accurate drawing was promised a $20 cash prize. The ones who were told that the man was black tended to exaggerate his typically black features, whereas those who were told he was white did the reverse, exaggerating his typically white features. Although the students were looking at exactly the same photograph, they perceived the image through a lens that was tinted with the racial label that the researcher provided earlier in the experiment. Unfortunately, we're also incapable of ignoring social labels when assessing a person's intelligence, a British psychologist has argued. For example, that the working class lacks the intelligence to be doctors. But it's actually very difficult to judge intelligence objectively. In one study, researchers showed that evaluators used labels as a tiebreaker when interpreting mixed evidence. Princeton University students were asked to decide whether a fourth grader named Hannah was performing above, below, or precisely at the level expected. During the first phase of the experiment, the students watched one of two videos. In one, Hannah was shown playing in a landscape park set in a wealthy neighborhood. A quick sweep of her school suggested that it was modern and sprawling, graced with athletic fields and an impressive playground. While the students watched the video, they read a brief biography of Hannah, which mentioned that her parents were both college graduates and now professionals. The other Princeton students were acquainted with a very different and less fortunate Hannah. They watched a video of Hannah playing in a fenced-in schoolyard with high-density brick buildings set amidst a neighborhood of small and run-down homes. This time, the biography described Hannah's parents as high school-educated, her father working as a meat packer, and her mother as a seamstress. At this point, the students watched a second video in which Hannah answered 25 questions from an achievement test. The questions were designed to assess Hannah's mathematical, reading, science, and social science skills. Instead of presenting a clear image of Hannah's ability, the video was ambiguous. Hannah was sometimes engaged, answering difficult questions correctly, and sometimes she seemed distracted and struggled with relatively easy questions. Hannah's ability was difficult to discern from the video, but some of the students began watching with the labels wealthy and college educated in mind, whereas the others began watching with the labels working class and high school educated in mind. These labels functioned as tiebreakers. The students who expected Hannah to succeed saw exactly that pattern of achievement in her responses, ignoring her missteps. Whereas those who expected less from Hannah saw exactly what the negative labels implied, in ignoring her intermittent mastery of the difficult questions. In the end, the lucky Hannah was judged to have performed above fourth grade level, whereas her unlucky counterpart seemed to perform below fourth grade level. The Hannah study showed that people are willing to view the world with the guidance of labels when faced with an otherwise unbreakable tie. Social labels aren't born dangerous. There's nothing inherently problematic about labeling a person right-handed or black or working class. But those labels are harmful to the extent that they become associated with meaningful character traits. At one end of the spectrum, the label right-handed is relatively free of meaning. We don't have strong stereotypes about right-handed people, and calling someone right-handed isn't tantamount to calling them unfriendly or unintelligent. In contrast, the terms black and working class are laden with the baggage of associations, perhaps some of them positive, but many of them negative. When a person is labeled black, we're primed to perceive the characteristics that we tend to associate with blackness. More generally, which is why students drew racially ambiguous faces with typically black features when they were told the face belonged to a black person. Participants in the experiment at Princeton similarly associated Hannah's working-class background with diminished intellect, so they tended to emphasize their failings and overlook her strengths when they watched her compete in an academic test, or rather complete an academic test. During the height of the civil rights struggle, one teacher showed just how willingly children adopt new labels. On April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, and the next day, thousands of American children went to school with a combination of misinformation and confusion. In Riceville, Iowa, Stephen Armstrong asked his teacher, Jane Elliott, why they shot that king. Elliott explained that the king was a man named King who was fighting against the discrimination of Negroes. The class of white students was confused, so Elliott offered to show them what it might be like to experience discrimination themselves. Elliott began by claiming that the blue-eyed children were better than the brown-eyed children. The children resisted at first. The brown-eyed majority was forced to confront the possibility that they were inferior, and the blue-eyed minority faced a crisis when they realized that some of their closest friendships were now forbidden. Elliot explained that the brown-eyed children had too much melanin, a substance that darkens the eyes and makes people less intelligent. Melanin caused the brownies, as Elliot labeled them, to be clumsy and lazy. Elliot asked the brownies to wear paper armbands, a deliberate reference to the yellow armbands that Jews were forced to wear during the Holocaust. Elliot reinforced the distinction by telling the brown-eyed children not to drink directly from the water fountain, as they might contaminate the blue-eyed children. Instead, the brownies were forced to drink from paper cups. Elliot also praised the blue-eyed children and offered them privileges like a longer lunch break, while she criticized the brown-eyed children and forced them to end lunch early. By the end of the day, the blue-eyed children had become rude and unpleasant toward their classmates, while even the gregarious brown-eyed children were noticeably timid and subservient. News of Elliot's demonstration traveled quickly, and she was interviewed by Johnny Carson. The interview lasted a few brief minutes, but its effects persist today. Elliot was pilloried by angry white viewers across the country. One angry white viewer scolded Elliot for exposing white children to the discrimination that black children face every day. Black children were accustomed to the experience, the viewer argued, but white children were fragile and might be scarred long after the demonstration ended. Elliot responded sharply by asking why we're so concerned about white children who experience this sort of treatment for a single day, while ignoring the pain of black children who experience the same treatment across their entire lives. Years later, Elliot's technique has been used in hundreds of classrooms and in workplace discrimination training courses where adults experience similar epiphanies. Elliot's approach shows how profoundly labels shape our treatment of other people and how even arbitrary damaging labels have the power to turn the brightest people into meek shadows of their potential selves. 4 years before Jane Elliott's classroom demonstration, two psychologists began a remarkable experiment at a school in San Francisco. Robert Rosenthal and Lenore Jacobson set out to show that the recipe for academic achievement contains more than raw intellect and a dozen years of schooling. Rosenthal and Jacobson kept the details of the experiment hidden from the teachers, students, and parents. Instead, they told the teachers that their test was designed to identify which students would improve academically over the coming year, students they labeled academic bloomers. In truth, the test was an IQ measure with separate versions for each school grade, and it had nothing to do with an academic blooming. As with any IQ test, some of the students scored quite well, some scored poorly, and many performed at the level expected from students of their age group. The next phase of the experiment was both brilliant and controversial. Rosenthal and Jacobson recorded the students' scores on the test and then labeled a randomly chosen sample of the students as academic bloomers. The bloomers performed no differently from the other students. Both groups had the same average IQ score, but their teachers were told to expect the bloomers to experience a rapid period of intellectual development during the following year. When the new school year arrived, each teacher watched as a new crop of children filled the classroom. The teachers knew very little about each student except whether they had been described as bloomers 3 months earlier. As they were chosen arbitrarily, the bloomers should have fared no differently from the remaining students. The students completed another year of school, and just before the year ended, Rosenthal and Jacobson administered the IQ test again. The results were remarkable. The first and second graders who were labeled bloomers outperformed their peers by 10 to 15 IQ points. Four of every five bloomers experienced at least a 10-point improvement, but only half the non-bloomers improved their score by 10 points or more. Rosenthal and Jacobson had intervened to elevate a randomly chosen group of students above their relatively unlucky peers. Their intervention was limited to labeling the chosen students bloomers and remaining silent on the academic prospects of the overlooked majority. Observers were stunned by these results, wondering how a simple label could elevate a child's IQ score a year later. Just as Princeton students perceived Hannah to be smarter than she was wealthier when she was wealthier, the teachers subconsciously emphasized the students' strengths and overlooked their weaknesses. When the teachers interacted with the bloomers, they were primed to see academic progress. Each time a bloomer answered a question correctly, her answer seemed to be an early sign of academic achievement. Each time she answered a question incorrectly, her error was seen as an anomaly, swamped by the general sense that she was in the process of blooming. During the year, then, the teachers praised these students for their successes, overlooked their failures, and devoted plenty of time and energy to the task of ensuring that they would grow to justify their promising academic labels. The label bloomer did not just resolve ambiguity. In other words, it changed the outcome for those students. That was reprinted by arrangement with the Penguin Press, a member of the Penguin Group, and that was from the Drunk Tank Pink by Adam Alter, copyrighted in 2013. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the health and science section. The first article here is Testing Your Dog's Smarts. Do you think your dog is smarter or more empathetic than other dogs? Well, now there's an online testing site that can tell you for sure, and in the process help scientists crowdsource data about the canine mind. Brian Hare, a professor of animal cognition at Duke University here in Durham, created the site called Dognition.com in hopes of identifying the cognitive style that makes for the best service dogs. Currently, less than a third of dogs that go through extensive training to be bomb sniffers or guides for the blind succeed. Figuring out the cognitive strengths of different breeds could improve that percentage and help all dog trainers sharpen their teaching methods. Most animals, including chimpanzees and wolves, are blind to much human body language. Pointing to where a treat is hidden, for instance, won't help them find it. But dogs understand human pointing because over thousands of years we've bred them to be highly attuned to our behavior and emotions. When it comes to the kind of survival skills needed in the wild, wolves make dogs look like idiots, Hare tells the New York Times. But when it comes to manipulating humans to meet all their needs, he says, dogs are geniuses. Data from Dognition has already shown that dogs have the strongest bonds with their owners, are also good at deceiving them. The pooches watch the humans closely for opportunities to steal extra food. Also from the health and science section, weight loss on the menu. Posting calories on restaurant menus hasn't done much to convince diners to order healthier fare and eat less. But a new study has found that labeling food with a different number, the amount of time you would have to briskly walk to burn it off, seems to be effective. Researchers at Texas Christian University gave 300 young adults a menu featuring hamburgers, chicken sandwiches, fries, salads, sodas, and water. A third of the menus had no nutritional labels, a third listed calorie counts for each item, and a third showed the number of minutes of walking it off it would take for them to walk off each item. The first two groups ordered and ate similarly. But the group that saw how much they would have to exercise to compensate for their choices ordered meals with significantly fewer calories and then ate less of them. Study author Mina Shah tells NPR.org that more consumers might think twice about ordering rich foods if they knew the effort required to use up the calories therein. It takes 2 hours of walking, for instance, to burn off 1/4-pound cheeseburger. And the health scare for the week catching too many Z's. We all know about the dangers of sleep deprivation, which has been linked to obesity, memory problems, and even early death. But a new study shows that a surprisingly large proportion of Americans are getting too much sleep, and that carries its own health risks, MyHealthNewsDaily.com reports. In surveys that asked participants to record how they spent their time in a 24-hour period, 37% of Americans sleeping for more than 9 hours, up from 28% in 1985. Meanwhile, the number of people who reported sleeping less than 6 hours a night declined to 9%. This turns the current concept of an increasingly sleep-deprived society on its head, say the study's authors, researchers at the University of Sydney. Previous research has linked sleeping for longer than 9 hours a night to an increased risk of heart disease, cognitive problems, and premature death, though it's unclear whether too much sleep is a symptom or a cause of poor health. Lying in bed longer than usual could also be a sign of insomnia, depression, diabetes, and the beginning stages of Alzheimer's disease. Now, from Health and Science, we'll turn to the Talking Point section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article here is entitled, Collins, A Pivotal Moment for Gay Athletes. I'm a 34-year-old NBA center. I'm black and I'm gay. With those three sentences, said Kevin Fallon in the DailyBeast.com, Jason Collins has become one of the biggest trailblazers in sports history, the first openly gay athlete currently playing in a major American team sport. In a first-person cover story in Sports Illustrated, the 7-foot-tall, 255-pound Collins said he'd grown tired of living in fear and denying his sexuality. I wish I wasn't the kid in the classroom raising his hand and saying, I'm different, Collins wrote. But since no other pro athlete has done it, he said, I'm raising my hand. To his immense relief, Collins' announcement brought an outpouring of support from other NBA players, said Howard Beck in the New York Times. Proud of at Jason Collins 34, tweeted Los Angeles Lakers star Kobe Bryant, don't suffocate who you are, added fellow Laker Steve Nash. Maximum respect. I'm already sick of hearing how brave Collins is, said Josh Barrow in Bloomberg.com. A 34-year-old free agent who has made $32 million in 12 years as a backup center, Collins waited until his career was ending and gay rights had become a popular cause before coming out. What took him so long? A true moral leader would have come out when his personal risks were much greater. Collins' awkward confession also insults many other gays, said J. Brian Lauder in Slate.com. He was so desperate to counteract femme-swishy gay stereotypes that he reminded everyone of how butch he's been as a player, frequently battering and fouling opponents. In other words, he's not that kind of gay. How sad that our first gay pro jock deems it necessary to assure nervous homophobes that gay athletes won't queen up the game. Give the guy a break, said Bob Cook in Forbes.com. Collins makes his living in a world where it gets overly stated what manhood means, and he's single-handedly taken on the job of making masculinity more inclusive to include people like him, big tough jocks who happen to be attractive to men. By coming out, he'll make it far easier for other gays in pro sports, as well as high school and college athletes, to leave their own closets. In 20 years, when it's not a big deal to watch a gay third baseman or a gay quarterback, we'll look back on Collins' announcement as the day things began to change. The next column here is entitled, The Sequester, Why the Democrats Caved. The fight over sequestration is over, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com, and the Democrats have lost. The automatic budget cuts that began March 1st because Congress and the White House couldn't agree on a deficit reduction deal finally caused a backlash last week when the Federal Aviation Administration furloughed 10% of its air traffic controllers. The manpower shortage caused delays in airports across the country and frequent flyers and airlines to erupt in outrage. marriage. Congress hastily passed a bill moving $253 million from other federal programs into salaries to keep the FAA fully staffed, and Obama reluctantly signed it. The Democrats could have stood firm and said to the country, look, how the sequester is affecting all of us, from the child denied entry to a Head Start program to defense contractors who've lost jobs. Instead, they caved, losing their leverage to renegotiate the remaining $85 billion in sequester cuts this year, guaranteeing that they will remain in place. They played a game of chicken with the Republicans, and they lost badly. Democrats lost because voters saw through their partisan gamesmanship, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The FAA's delays were deliberate and avoidable, but the White House hoped they'd create a groundswell of opposition to the sequester. But even Obama couldn't convince the public that a mere 4% cut to the FAA's $15 billion budget could translate to 10% staff reductions, and 6,700 flights forced off schedule daily. Despite the administration's scare tactics, it's now obvious that the sequester hasn't affected the basic services that voters expected from the government. Tell that to the sequester's quieter victims, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. They include seniors receiving an estimated 4 million fewer meals on wheels and 70,000 children excluded from Head Start programs and unemployed workers whose benefits will be curtailed. Make no mistake, the sequester will continue to take a silent, uncertain toll. But it's only when well-off business travelers and vacationers kick up a fuss that Washington acts. Sadly, poor people have no clout in our political system, said Howard Kurtz in the DailyBeast.com. The general public, meanwhile, is sick of 2 years' worth of stories about budget gridlock in Washington and just can't bear to listen anymore. Soon the sequester story will fade from the headlines, even if both parties agree that cutting spending in this indiscriminate way is dumb. Now a few short items as we reach the end of our program this week. Stores, restaurants, and other companies that suffered property damage or lost income due to the Boston bombings may not get insurance payouts if the attack is officially declared an act of terrorism by federal officials. After the 9/11 attacks, insurance companies changed most policies, business policies, to exempt losses stemming from terrorism unless the customer pays extra for terrorism coverage. A 5-foot-long piece of twisted metal from one of the planes that flew into the World Trade Center on 9/11 was just found a couple of weeks ago, several blocks away from the tower's location. The piece, a motorized part of a wing flap, was wedged into an 18-inch wide space between a luxury apartment building and the planned Ground Zero Mosque that caused protests in 2011. The poll watch for this week, 42% of Americans are unsure of whether Obamacare remains a law. 19% incorrectly believed it has been repealed by Congress or overturned by the Supreme Court. 49% say they don't know how it would affect them and their families. And 45% of Americans say they would support using military force against Syria if the country used chemical weapons against rebels. 31% would oppose that intervention. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.